All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck dumpsters? What's happening? How you doing? It's Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. Welcome to it. Interesting show today. Interesting because it's an outsider show. Outsiders. Yes. The dudes from Endless Boogie are here. Paul Major and Jesper Eklo. But Paul Major is not just a guy in a band. He's a guy that sort of defined the weird vinyl pursuit of the grails that are small runs of usually independently produced records from the 60s and 70s. As a long intro, but I'd been hearing about this guy. I sort of knew him. I'd seen pictures of him. I came upon Endless Boogie. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But they're on the show today. It was a surprise to have Jesper in as well. But it worked out pretty good. But there's other things going on. I'm playing Carnegie Hall tomorrow night. I'm recording this on Tuesday because I got to shoot. It's just very busy. I'm feeling good about Carnegie, but I'm feeling a slight bleak cloud over me because my little baby, my little La Fonda cat, is sick, and I don't know if she's going to make it, and I can't stand it, but I don't know what to do. The last time I talked to you guys, I'd recorded that on a couple days early too, but I had them both at the vet. Buster's got no balls. That went fine. He seems okay. Doesn't seem much different. Maybe he's a little more chill, but not much. Monkey felt sick to me. Fonda was sick. I brought her in, but she was the first one with the sickness. And Monkey seemed sick. I brought him in. So I go pick up Monkey, and they give him antibiotics. He's okay, but Fonda's not okay. Fonda, you know, it was a big ordeal. Fucking sad, man. 12-year-old cat. You know, you hear about these cats that live forever, these 16-year-old, 19-year-old, 22-year-old cats. And I don't know what's going to happen. I got to go to New York tomorrow. And I don't know if she's going to make it until when I'm back. And, you know, Sarah's going to drop by, and I've got someone at the house who's going to feed the cats as well. And, you know, but I guess this is the way it is. But, you know, even if you sit there and you kind of process it and accept it, you know, you live with these things. These cats are the longest relationships I've had in my life, really, 12 years. And she's just fucking sick, and there's nothing I can do. I thought I was going to have to put her down today, but this guy gave me some hope, and I guess you don't put a cat down if they still are kind of eating and not, doesn't seem like she's in pain. She just seems out of it. So that's sort of hanging over me. And, even with little Buster, there's part of me that's like that evil little fuck. He put the bad mojo on the cats. He fucking, I don't know. So now I'm looking at him like some sort of evil seed, and I'm glad Monkey's okay, but how long's he got? I guess, you know, I'm okay. But, you know, I feel like I've done everything I could for this cat. And now it's just a waiting game, and I got to go to New York with my cat, you know, sort of deathly ill, and do Carnegie Hall. Look, I know it's not my girlfriend or my brother or my parents or whatever, but in terms of being close to something, I've been with this female thing for a long time. It's an odd little cat. And I just hope she pulls through. Hope she pulls through. But I'm not optimistic, but maybe I should be. Maybe I should, put my brain in a good place, and maybe she'll pull out of it. I don't mean to be bleak, you guys. Carnegie Hall, I was, you know, I'm kind of nervous about that, and I was kind of full of dread and anxiety, but it's like, let's just make it exciting. I'm excited. I looked at my set. I've got a lot of good stuff I want to do. It should be exciting. I have no sense of the hall, but I know it's this place. There's part of me that's like thinking like, I'm not a virtuoso. Even that joke, the sort of like, you know, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. I'm like, did I practice enough? How about persistence, persistence, persistence? and talent. What about that? I got a little of that. Got a little of both of those. I practiced. I'm excited, and I'm excited. You know, we basically sold the place out. There's some single tickets left in the high seats. Got some friends coming. But I think I'm just going to hang low before the show. I might do a set at over there at Housing Works Bookstore in Soho Thursday night. They're raising money for an AIDS charity. I think I'm going to go on that show with Garofalo and Lori Kilmartin. I think Andy Blitz is going to be there. And my buddy Nate Bargatze. Do a little short warm-up in a bookstore for the Carnegie Hall show. There's some dates coming up I'd like to tell you about because I'm excited. I'm going to be heading to Nashville and Chicago soon. I think those are the ones that are the closest to to where we are at now. I'll be in Nashville on November 19th at the James K. Polk Theater. I'll be at the Vic Theater in Chicago December 3rd. And then we move into January. But those are the two gigs after Carnegie before the end of the year. Nice winter gigs in Nashville and in Chicago. Going to be chilly. But me and Brendan McDonald, the wizard behind the curtain of WTF, my producer and business partner, were down at the Now Hear This podcast festival. And it was a pretty good time. We did something we never really did before live. We did a podcast that you'll be able to hear in time where the two of us talked about WTF. And Brendan put a lot of prep into it, and I did what I do, which might be the opposite of that. But the way I look at it, either you kind of like put hands-on prep in or you do something at enough times in your life where you're prepped down to the core for anything. So I went with that attitude. I'm prepped because I live it. He was prepped because he got it all down and structured it. But the trick was he didn't tell me what he was going to bring up. There were all these emails, some outtakes, some stories. So I told him not to show any of it to me or tell me anything. There was bits and pieces of podcasts. And it turned out to be pretty fun. I like thinking on my feet, reacting. Things came up. Did a nice hour and a half show. We'll be playing that podcast for you soon. But it was fun, man. And I think me and Brendan are going to be a team on the road. I think that's going to happen. We're not going to do birthday parties or bar mitzvahs, but it was sort of this, you know, I've done a few of those sort of keynote things or presentation type things myself, and they're okay. But doing it with Brendan would be great. You know why? Because he prepped. He got structure and everything. And I just have to lean into it. That's all I got to do. I got choked up. But then you don't want it to become a shtick. You know, like, hey, Mark, you're going to cry at the end of that one? Got choked up because I was happy for us. I was happy for him. And as you know, I get choked up often. I'm trying to keep it together with the cat situation. All right. So Paul Major and Jesper Eklo, the band Endless Boogie. I had gotten a bunch of records at some point. I go through a lot of records, and I got this one record, Endless Boogie. It had nothing on the cover. It had this weird profile of a mountain that looked like a thing, a guy. And I put it on, and I'm like, what is this, man? It's just a moving groove, deep rock kind of blues boogie groove. And I was like, this is real. And then it turned out to be this band, Endless Boogie. And I talked to my buddy, Matt Sweeney, who happens to be involved with Endless Boogie occasionally, just like Matt Sweeney is involved with fucking everything cool and hot and hip and music. It's like the Zelig of art and music. But so he told me about Paul Major, who I was curious about anyways, because my buddy Dan Cook down at Gimme Gimme Records knows about Paul Major because Paul Major back in the day had this newsletter that was very important and very specific to record nerds about his finds. He just spent a lifetime searching for these small releases, rock records primarily in the 60s and 70s. And he invented this niche of vinyl collecting. And since then, he's become sort of a mythic person, and he's defined this genre of collecting, and now there's a lot of labels reissuing some of the records that he unearthed and are impossible to find because there's a limited number of them. So I was kind of curious about that because I've been kind of in the vinyl rabbit hole myself. And Jesper's in the band, but apparently when Paul used to live down the village, I believe it was, back in the day, he was a sort of wizard of vinyl and music. And there were dudes that used to hang out, like, you know, Steve Malkmus was involved in one of the early on with Endless Boogie. And they used to hang out and play records at his place and look to his wisdom of music and weird off the grid type of sounds, man. And Jesper was one of the dudes. And they decided to start this band because Paul always wanted to be in a band and he'd been in bands. And that's where Endless Boogie came from. But they got a new album coming out early next year called Vibe Killer. You can check them out at Endless Boogie on Facebook or go to noquarter.net. That's the label. And so this is sort of an interesting off the beaten path episode of this show, this type of interview. I hope you enjoy it. This is me, Paul Major, and Jesper Eklo. It's a very weird thing. Like, I didn't really know exactly who you were. And here's what happened. I get sent records a few years ago. I get sent a lot of records by just people, and a lot of them stink. And I put on, I didn't know what it was, but I put it because, you know, the cover's menacing and it's nondescript. And I put on Endless Boogie Long Island. And I go through a lot of records, man. And I'm just listening to this thinking, like, what the fuck is this? And then all of a sudden I'm like, holy shit, this is real. This is deep. Where the fuck is this from? So then I got to go track you down and figure out what you're about. And then I find a picture of you with holding a Morgan record. There's not a lot of pictures of you, but you're holding that Morgan record. And I'm like, that's something that Dan Cook sold me over at Gimme Gimme. And then like I just started doing the vinyl thing a few years ago. And then I started researching a little bit of what you do. And I'm like, it's this guy's fault. he's the guy that made us want these records. You are sort of responsible, aren't you?
Well, I certainly had my hand in it.
Yeah.
It wasn't intentional, but I am to blame for a lot of this.
Yeah, because like now I'm starting to learn more about these like these records that were, you know, these small releases or sort of artist release records that are now being reissued. Because vinyl's all of a sudden the shit. And now I'm learning about bands that no one has ever heard of. What was the, like, let's go back, you know, to where this starts. Because I love, you know, I love Endless Boogie. I just got the second record. So I've got Full House Head. And I've got Long Island. I'll have the new one. When's that coming out?
It's still going to be a little while. We got a lot of it done. Then yeah. I broke my arm. That pushed us back.
How'd you break your arm, man?
Carrying an amplifier, not paying attention to where I was putting my feet.
Injured in battle.
Yeah.
Rock and roll battle. So where did the reputation, or which was earned, of finding these records? I mean, where does that start? The one thing I learned from your lead is that how mind-fucked we are by mainstream music. And that, like, you know, listening to some of the stuff that's been reissued that you have, you know, discovered in certain ways or brought to the public's attention, like Morgan, is like, I start to realize, like, there's so much great fucking music out there that's just lost forever. Is that what compelled you initially?
Or it seemed to be lost forever. Of course, now, speaking of Morgan, as a kid, when I had that album when I was a little kid, it was blowing my mind in isolation in Louisville, Kentucky, you know, saying, I want to be part of this world.
And right.
The only way I'm getting it is through these sort of records, like a lifeline to there.
Right.
It is kind of a mind blower to me that you can look on YouTube and see that like 250, 300,000 people have listened to Love off that album. And
right.
When I was a kid in Kentucky, you know, of course, I was thinking, well, maybe 200 people, you know, by the time I'm dead will have been into this record. But it started for me really at the end of 1966 when I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
I was a math nerd and this and that, totally oblivious to music, even though I'm sure I must have heard Satisfaction on the radio and
of
some
course.
Stuff before.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And then towards the end of 1966 in Louisville, Kentucky, I heard Psychotic Reaction on the radio.
Right.
And it was like all bets are off. You know, everything's up for grabs. Yeah. It's like life changes, you know, the fuzz guitars, the, you know.
No equation for this. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like the next day, I'm mowing lawns to get enough change together to go wander off down the sort of hippie district of Louisville, Kentucky,
right.
Bardstown Road.
Right.
Look for all the used through all the used records and, you know, ones that have that, like Morgan, wow, you know, it was before I had any access to pot or LSD or stuff. And I'm looking at the track saying, this is that long one. Maybe this is one of those tracks that's like tripping.
Yeah, 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 right, right. That, something you heard about from the magazines or whatever.
Yeah, I get some tips from the magazines. There was a magazine, I guess, available to me
right
before I tuned into other rock magazines. There was this one, Hit Parader, that was very...
I remember that. And didn't that have... Is that the one... Did that have some lyrics?
Right.
Yeah,
they would have the lyrics to all the hits.
Right.
And they would have some good interviews, and they sort of got on to the underground thing in a mainstream way. And in the back, they would always review 5 albums. Mm-hmm. And in some of those issues at the time when it came out, there'd be a review of 50 Foot Hose or something amazing.
Yeah, I don't even know what you're talking about now. But that's why, whose record was that? That was the name of a band?
It was the name of a band from San Francisco that mixed sort of underground rock with experimental music, lots of made by himself, the leader of the band, electronic instruments and oscillators and,
right.
and things like that. So it was like a science fiction adventure or something.
Right. And so you just started like, by looking at the portal that the cover enabled you, you're mostly reacting to psychedelic artwork initially.
Yeah, psychedelic artwork or anything that just looked strange or anything that looked like, oh, it's coming from that angle of the Twilight Zone or
right,
something.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when did you finally try drugs?
That would have been towards the end of high school. I was isolated. And finally, I met up with a couple of friends that were into that. And then we play music and that, you know. And I remember the first time I ever smoked pot was when I had my first job when I was 16
at
a pizza place. My father set it up for me.
The job, not the pot.
No. And I remember then when I'm working there the very first day, I'm the busboy in this place, which turned out to be a crazy place. As it turns out,
like
then
why?
Walking out the first day, and the guy's in the back in the kitchen rolling a joint. And my mother is sitting outside in the car waiting to pick me up.
Yeah.
And I'm there like, you know, I want to get in on this. And she's waiting outside, and they're now.
And you did it, and then got in the car with your mom?
Got in the car, you know. It's like, can you tell? Can they tell? Can she tell?
And that's the only thing you experience at first high is like, can they tell? You're not, you don't even put yourself in a position where you could enjoy it.
Well, it's true. It's all like that. Except I knew when I got to the house, the first thing I wanted to do was go up to my bedroom and start looking at my album covers.
Did that work?
It worked. Yeah,
I bet. So what? Like, so when did you start playing guitar?
When I was 13,
yeah,
would be my parents to be real nice because I was obsessed with it. Then they bought me a plastic toy guitar for Christmas.
Yeah,
well, you know, a toy
at 13,
maybe. I don't know.
Not like a K.
Not too big.
A little long, a little shorter than that.
Yeah, probably a 2/3 size of plastic. And
right.
I instantly took my crayons out and put psychedelic designs on it. And,
of course.
Started playing along. And then I realized, it's nylon strings. It's not getting the sound. And then I realized if I tape a pencil under the bridge, it would make the strings buzz on the toy guitar. So it would go.
You needed the buzz. Got to get that toy guitar buzzing. So like so when did you start? What was the process of life where you started kind of amassing these records, and then like how did your musical journey start? So you're stuck in Louisville. So when did your mind blow and you had to get out, or how long of a process was that? Where'd you end up?
It was a while. For several years, I was pretty isolated, just buying all these obscure records and
not knowing anything, just because you wanted to listen to them.
Yeah, just because I wanted to listen to them. And you know,
what are some of the other names?
You know, like bands like Silver Apples, and then ultra obscure in Louisville, Kentucky, the Velvet Underground, and bands and the Detroit bands, the MC5,
right,
Stooges, and so forth.
But those were relatively mainstream releases, right? You could get
they were around, not a lot, but they were around.
So there were still
private pressings, and the homemade records sort of came
later.
But
this is sort of like the punk thing, because when I talked to guys who started in punk, the only way to get those records was to have somebody send them over to you, or like there was a network of people that would move these records around. But I guess when you're in a town like Louisville and there's a local record store, they wouldn't necessarily carry the Velvet Underground or the Stooges.
No, they're when it first came out, there'd be a few places. And I first got White Light, White Heat was in a Kmart in the cutout bins, the 33 cents each deletions, which seemed to hit those bins not long after the records came out.
Well, that was the amazing thing about being in an area that isn't hip, is that like all the hip shit just gets, you know, trashed. Like, same with clothes and shit. If you want to get a good deal at Nordstrom Rack and on an overcoat, go buy it in Arizona.
Yeah. No, it was a good time, definitely, because and when I did start going to used record stores and looking, I always knew the first place to look is wherever they put all the stuff they thought was garbage, the cheap stuff, because where all this good stuff's going to be.
Right.
The Frank Zappa record will be on the wall for a lot of money. And then the local band, Fraction or one of the heavy local psychedelic bands, would be like, who wants that? You know, they're locals. They didn't get anywhere, you know, here.
So you started buying like, you know, Kentucky rock bands?
Yeah. I stumbled across a few of those. There weren't that many, I guess, by the time I left. But there were a few local ones. A band called Crystal was one of them.
And
I started buying those, and I was just packing them away, and living in St. Louis for a while, was buying some more there. And when
you moved to St. Louis
from
Louisville?
From Louisville.
What would compel you?
Well, college.
Oh, yeah. So you're still keeping up your grades and doing the math?
That didn't last too long once I got to college. I did keep my grades up. I did, good at all that. But it switched to music pretty quickly. I met another friend then.
In St. Louis?
Was into the same stuff, and we started what we call a pre-punk band now in St. Louis in the mid-70s called the Moldy Dogs.
Did you release any records?
No.
But you just jammed?
Just made tapes and played kind of strange local shows and so forth. We started as a duo, acoustic guitar, and I would play fuzz guitar, and we would do Gimme Danger or do I'm Waiting for the Man and things like that, and then started writing our own songs and play around town at like pizza joints and places like that.
Did people come?
Yeah. Not a whole lot, but we did connect within in the St. Louis area, the other couple of pockets of people that were also into that kind of stuff through that. And enough people did come to one place I remember called the Pastrami Joint we used to play at.
Yeah.
Enough barefoot teenagers started showing up each time we play there that they say, you can't play here anymore. You know, these people come in, they don't buy any pastrami. They just come in and like clutter the place up
No shoes and their stinky feet. So you survived. So you were like 13 or 14 during the late 60s, right?
Yeah.
And then so now, you know, in the 70s, you're like, you know, later teens.
I was born in 1954. So
you're
13 and 67.
Right.
Turned 13.
So you were you were prime headspace for that whole fucking mindfuck.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The timing couldn't have been better to, you know, hear that song and hear fuzz guitars for the first time.
Right. So it was like, I can't imagine what that would be like to hear that shit for reals for the first time without any context.
Right. When it's happening, it did seem like it was something leaking from this amazing, mysterious other world.
San Francisco?
Like you could feel the vibration of that. Yeah, I would be looking at Life magazine at the pictures in there, and I think there's a famous picture in there where there's a picture of a guy sitting in a corner who believes he's an orange. And I'm thinking, I want to understand, like, you know, I want to be an orange too.
Yeah. Jesper.
Yeah.
Where'd you meet Paul?
Oh, I met Paul maybe early 90s. I moved to New York from Sweden, and he'd already been legendary in the record collecting circuit.
Were you a record collector?
Yeah, I worked in a record store. I was into strange music. But Paul used to publish this catalog every now and then. This is how Paul made all his money, since he last quit his last day job in 1980 or whatever.
So he
used to amass all his records and make these incredible catalogs that had the best descriptions you've ever read about.
Really?
Records.
So that was
and most, you know, 99% of the records you read about, you'd never heard of before.
So that was this. So you go from, and then you guys, and you play guitar as well.
Yeah, the thing was, like, we really loved hanging out with Paul because we'd go up to his magical apartment on the Upper West Side.
Full of records.
Sit there, and he would just play the weirdest music you ever heard. And like, those were like, you know, that room he had was like kind of like a cathedral to us, you know.
Where was that? In New York City?
Yeah,
in
Upper West Side, near right by Columbia University, basically.
So you were like one of those guys where guys who you let into the inner circle would come to your house and they'd be like, oh, this is Paul's house. This is where it all happened.
Yeah, no, it felt like you were allowed into like a magical universe, you know, and it was an honor to be there, you know.
You built a magical universe.
Yeah, it just,
it was a very small one, but it was like so special, and we really loved those moments. And the way the band started, I guess, we just try to get to hang out with Paul more and like get him out of the house because he was just sitting up there.
All right, let's move up to that. So from St. Louis, you're doing music there, and then where do you go next?
That was January 1977.
Yeah,
I remember we had the first St. Louis punk rock festival.
Who was there? Who came?
Uh, About 300 or 400 people turned out, and it was local bands, the Moldy Dogs, a 14-year-old girl group called the Welders, who were crazily into the Ramones as soon as the first album came out, and a group called the Cigarette Butts, I guess that was another punk group of St. Louis. So it's January 77, and a blizzard hits right the night of the show, and everything's good. And then we said, well, we got to go to L.A. or New York, and while the blizzard was raging outside, it seemed like L.A. was the... Yeah. A smart place, you know, beaches and getting warm. And it was a little before the punk scene had started happening in L.A., I guess. But at that very beginning, we spent half a year, I guess, basically here, and then decided, oh, we should have went to New York. We went back to St. Louis.
Wait, so you went to L.A.?
Yeah, yeah.
And you just hit the wall quick, or?
No, we went around with our demo to record companies and stuff like that.
Who was in the band with you?
Extremely no interest. Was it just two of you? A guy named Wolf Roxon. Two of us that came out. The other guys in the band stayed in St. Louis at the time. And we just came out figuring, we'll come out and, you know.
Was it a short trip or you planned to move?
Sort of, yeah, planned to move. But after being here for a while,
we realized
we should have went to New York.
You know, why? Because it just so wasn't happening out here, the expanse of it?
Yeah, it was before it was happening. The Germs hadn't formed yet and so forth, and early bands. And there were just a few shows like happening, the Weirdos, and some bands were playing in that. But it was just like when the ball was getting rolling on the local scene.
There wasn't a scene yet.
Right. And in New York, there had been a scene for a while.
Right.
And
since what, 73?
Yeah. I mean, and early on, I guess extending... You know, all the way back, you know, like it blew my mind. I saw a poster for Suicide playing a show in 1971. So it goes.
Which has the line "Punk music by Suicide" on it.
Is that where that came from?
I don't know, but they were one of the very first bands to use it in that context.
Because, like, I talked to Mike Watt, they all consider themselves punk rock, and it was just whatever didn't fit in. That was what that was. Right. You know, whatever you were inventing in that moment. When did you go to New York? Did it finally?
So that was fall of 77.
Okay.
Yes, we drove up. We had a house to use free in New Jersey for a little bit, so we went there. And
how's that work? Were you working? How were you making money at that point?
Well, you know, one of the amazing things is when we were in L.A., we had an apartment. I mean, a dinky little apartment on Sunset and Vine, but it was $125 a month split between two guys. So it's like we need $60-odd a month.
Could pull that.
And New York, when I got there, there was apartment near the corner of Bleecker and McDougal, that was $198 a month.
Get the fuck out of here.
So we had to each come up with $99. I'm in New York, people saying, yeah, New York is going to eat you up. You got a stroke. I'm thinking, fuck, I don't really need a job.
Right.
Or whatever. You know,
for $99.
So pretty
bucks.
Soon on, I guess it was mostly time to do the bands and, you know, be a wild kid and all that stuff in the city. And
so you didn't have jobs?
I did work in a Village Oldies legendary store in New York. That was on the corner of Bleecker and Sullivan Street as a day sort of job thing for a couple of years, really. But it was more of a hangout place. And the punk
I kind of remember that place.
Yeah, it had started.
I do remember that place because I used to go there. My grandmother lived in Jersey, and I'd go visit her and go into the city and walk around. I remember Bleecker Bob's.
Right.
So was it before that a little bit?
Actually, it was the guy that ran Village Oldies was named Al Tromers. And originally him and Bleecker Bob were partners and had a shop further to the west further to the east on Bleecker Street coming off the 60s and that. And then they sort of fell out or whatever and each had their own store in Bleecker Bob's. And Broadway Al. Then he decided, since Bleecker Bob's Bleecker Bob, I'm going to be Broadway Al.
Oh, that was it?
And
I remember Bleecker Bob. When I first went in there, all the 45s on the wall were like Beatles and shit. And then, like, I remember going back there years later, it was all punk rock. It just shifted focus completely. And in the back, they had all those great T-shirts and shit, right?
Mm-hmm,
and posters and stuff. Am I remembering it properly?
Yeah. And it did happen when those waves of punk started happening at the end of 76 and 77. Then those shops grabbed onto those things. All of a sudden, the Pere Ubu singles were available and all these kind of things
were around
the
Beatles started to move a little off.
A little off, yeah.
So when you were working in Village Oldies, what was the scene? Who was coming in? What was the deal?
It was a crazy scene. The store was, half of it was a record store and half of it was a head shop store run by junkies. So it was really crazy, my first exposure to lots of junkie insanity going on. And
that was still like big CBGB's time.
Yeah,
all pretty vital, right?
It was still 77? Vital happening there at, I guess, mainly CBGB's and Max's.
Right.
And a few other places to play, sort of between the two, was one called Great Gildersleeves that was more like when Tom Petty was in town before he got famous. He would play there. It was like the old school rock and roll bar, but some of the
regular rock
stuff started leaking in there. But yeah. At that point, it was really centered around those places. They were still happening. And I felt like, oh, I'm here a little late because a lot of the bands were off gone or that, but the scene, it did continue.
You felt like you were a little late?
Yeah, like, okay, now the Ramones and bands like that, they're never playing there much anymore because they're out touring and stuff. They
yeah.
enough success. But there was a second wave, so I remember one of the first bills he played on at Max's was with a band called Red Transistor, which is a guy named Von Elmo, who's an intensely crazy, way out there person. Made one of the biggest walls of sound I ever heard. And I remember walking in there and my band, at the time, my partner in the band was wanting to go power pop, and I'm hearing all this incredible, crazy noise that's flashing me back to those first fuzz guitars and
stuff.
And
like, I feel like a kid. Like, I got a bunch of records in there, and I had no idea about anything. Like, I was going down this list of, like, I just got turned on to that Growers of Mushrooms record.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know nothing about them. How the fuck? But that's probably mainstream to you, right?
Sort of, yeah. Leafhound,
yeah.
In a way, I guess it was, and
Help Yourself is another one.
It was
one.
Actually on a real label, some of those records.
Right. Are you anti-real label?
No, I didn't make much of a distinction until I started getting some private pressings and started thinking, well, these are less filtered than even the crazier real ones.
So when did that realization happen? When you were at Village Oldies?
No, a little before. Actually, it was in New Jersey, I guess, when we were there just before we came to the city.
Yeah.
We had a little recording studio in the basement of the house.
Yeah.
And one day in the mail comes a package with three copies of a homemade record, Kenneth Higney, Attic Demonstration.
How'd you get it? I mean, who?
He saw a little ad we had for the studio in the basement of the house. And he said, well, Mom, here, I'm promoting myself. Here's three copies of my album. I hope you can,
He wanted to record more or?
No, he just wanted us to help him. He was just firing them off to people to try to further his recording career.
Uh-huh.
And he was basically trying to make sort of demos for country artists or something, doing something kind of straight, but it came out completely, I don't want to say deranged, not condescending. It came out brilliantly wrong, like a work of genius.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you were able to identify that.
And I did it, and I sort of linked it to some other things I had, and then I became more aware, oh, okay, yeah, people make their own records. And it's a good bet a lot of these people made their own records are going to come up with something that's unlike anything you ever heard before. So it was like that leaking in a window of another dimension, getting right inside this person's head and their life. And where some of the things that they think are the things that went wrong are the things that make it brilliant because nobody edited all the good stuff out.
No know-it-all or guy with an angle.
So that got me going on the private pressings. I really shifted gears from the punk and the psychedelic and a lot of things into checking out every homemade record.
And some of those can be almost loungy, not necessarily, genre-based, mm-hmm. just there's an honesty to it.
Yeah, there's an honesty. And there are lounge ones that they still satisfy, like, okay, it's some broken-down lounge act, the Whatever's Live at the Rooster Tail Lounge or something. And something will happen on that record that is also got their own personality.
Right.
Something
like,
will
the
go
fuck?
Crazy. They'll have an idea to do some song some weird way and it'll just be outrageous.
So what were some of the other names that you were picking up then? So what's his name? The guy's name? Higney?
Kenneth Higney.
Did you go seek these guys out and develop relationships with them?
Yeah, a little later I did. When I got to New York and realized, I can wander from one record store, buy some records, take them over to another store and double the price and pay my rent kind of quick and spend all my time looking for records.
And what were you doing to know about what these records are worth? It was just your sensibility?
There was nothing there. Yeah, just my sensibility or something. Hearing these are special to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was aware at that point, there's a thing called record collecting besides the Beatles and Elvis or something.
Right. So, and the whole other world out there.
So, yeah. So I started running into and getting correspondence with people into a similar thing in cities all around the world, I guess, after I started putting little ads in collector magazines. And
what was the ad? Just
auctions.
Sort of like...
Just interesting records that I had found and gotten copies. And a little later, I started tracking the bands down to see if they had copies in the attic somewhere or something. So a little network developed around the world. It was very secretive and mysterious.
This is before he started seeing the reviews though, right?
Yeah, I didn't see them until maybe 1986 or 7 or so. Going several years.
You developed this secret society.
Sort of, yeah. Around the world, there were certain guys in different countries like South America. That's how I got turned on to all South American things and stuff that you wouldn't even hardly ever run across in U.S. record stores and certainly not in the Midwest at the time.
Sure.
I would be in touch with people and say, what do you want from the U.S.? You know, what kind of stuff you want? I'll send you a box. And since I don't know anything about your music, you know what I'm into. Send me the stuff you think is the stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I would get these boxes of records from around the world and this sort of, you know, network of people in every local location filtering their
local Netherlands, records. South America,
yeah,
Germany.
South America, Germany. Yeah. And places like that. And I would be trading the U.S. ones and sending them.
Were you like on fire with it? Like obsessed? Possessed?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. I was completely on fire with it. I couldn't. I became a complete addict to the thrill of discovery. It's sort of like back in those days, since everything was so unknown, it was like every day or two, mm-hmm. some record would come my way that would just fry my brain. I think
that
seemed endless, you know.
Beautiful.
Where nowadays, I guess it's from that sort of vintage, especially nowadays, it's sort of like, oh, a couple records will come along in a year that deserve to be up with all those.
And also at that time, though, in the 70s, and I imagine some of the stuff you were drawing from was probably a decade old as well. So you're drawing all the way back to the mid-60s, probably with some of the stuff that was coming through, right?
Yeah.
So like that was the time where everything was changing anyway. So there was shit that never existed ever anywhere before. Mm-hmm. It's a little harder to find that now.
Right.
To find stuff that like this never existed before this thing.
Right. Yeah, like to name a band now that's doing something that seems unprecedented as a tall order.
It is, because like what the hell, it's all been tapped in mm-hmm. a way. So like when you were getting South American records and that kind of stuff, I mean, what was that stuff?
It was pretty amazing. When the first box came, I remember it was about 40 or 50 albums, and it was a box wrapped with cloth around it and a big green and inspected by U.S. Customs.
Yeah.
Sticker on it, wondering what kind of stuff was in there.
Right.
I pulled it out, and the album covers looked crazy. And it was like a, you know, it was hard rock and things uh-huh. like that, but it seemed to have a little bit more of an unhinged, wild sort of.
Yeah, you know, yeah, and with maybe a little Latin texture to it, a little beat or anything. Like, did it seem of its place?
Yeah, it seemed of its place.
Uh-huh. Like
you could see who these bands were tuning into,
right.
Hendrix and so
forth.
Yeah. And that, it had their own local flavor.
So when did you know that you had like, you know, you were dealing with a living, like you were dealing with like, you know, like it, when did it sort of expand into where you probably had to buy a new apartment
it
or a storage bin?
Fairly soon after the first couple of years in New York,
uh-huh.
I started realizing, I should put all my time into this. And so that'd be like maybe 1981 or two.
And
or
was it
like
pretty that. Easy process, wasn't it? It just kind of unfolded kind of organically, right?
It sort of did, yeah. I remember the very first time that got me going thinking, this, you know, I should get out of this crazy store I'm in.
That was just Village Oldies? You never worked at Bleecker Bob's?
No. He tried to get me to work for him because somehow people thought I was responsible back then or something. But
they probably also saw you had this weird talent for picking records, right?
Well, I don't think that had quite developed like where it translated into the store or something like that.
Right.
It was more meeting the people, and what sparked it, two German guys came in to the store and they were buying
Village
some of
Oldies.
Village Oldies. And they were buying some of the like records like Chocolate Watch Bands or whatever. Type records from the store.
I got that.
They were saying, can you tell
me
where
that, right?
Yeah,
they just reissued it not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Chocolate Watch Band, there's two records, right?
Three.
Yeah.
But
so these German guys?
They came in and then they were saying, can you tell us where else can we go to get more records like this? And I thought, you know, you should come over to my apartment, you know. So I did a deal, you know, they left a stack about that high record saying, you know, just send them to us when you get a chance, you know, total trust and the whole deal. And they
bought them off?
Bought a bunch of them. And then I started going into it and realizing, okay, I should advertise in the record collector magazines.
And at that time, were those magazines mostly geared towards like 78s and like really old shit?
Lots of the 60s stuff was going by then.
Is that how you determined what you would price shit at?
It would be sort of instinct. Yeah, if something was around, I'd get an idea what's going for then or however that. But I guess a lot of the things it would just be how much it got me off, you know, affected it. And is it, you know, are there a zillion copies of this out there?
Or am I going to be able to get this drug back?
Always could back then. Was another good thing, too. It could be talked out of records that took me a long time to get it or something, because back then, before the internet and so forth, with all the best records in the cheapest sections of the stores, it seemed like unending supply. You know, I go back to Kentucky once a year and hit all the hippie head shops and used stores. And the records that I passed up from a year before,
right,
because I ran out of money,
yeah,
would still be sitting in the stores a year later. And I get
no
them
wanted
time.
Them.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's exciting. I wish we lived in that world. I wish I knew enough back then to do that. Now, when you're at Village Oldies, like, were there any of those sort of punk dudes around that were coming in sort of trying to use you as a resource to kind of, you know, break their brain open? Like, who was around then? Did you, like, were some of the junkie punks still around?
Yeah,
junkie
punks were around. A lot of, like, British bands were
Verlaine
coming over.
Verlaine and Thunders and Richard Hell, were they there?
Yeah, they were around. And
did you know
that?
But
I didn't collect. I didn't connect with them through record connecting. It was more that I had a band called The Sorcerers, sort of a hard rock influenced by Hawkwind and Motorhead type.
Hawkwind,
band.
Are you responsible for me knowing about Hawkwind?
No.
Because that's recent for me. Like, I just got turned on to the Groundhogs just like within the last 2 years. How the fuck did I not know about that?
This is great, though. Like, it's really good to have amazing stuff still ahead of you in life.
There's
you know
so
I mean?
Much, dude.
Yeah, it's awesome. This is beautiful.
But were you always a record nerd?
Kind of, but I mean, like, you know, I grew up later, you know, since I was born in the late 60s, but it was before the internet, so you just had to know older people that will turn you on to
need
stuff.
Need the older brother, the guide.
Yeah, just like, I mean, all my friends were older because, like, they had some wisdom to give you, you know, because before you could just type it into Google, you know.
They're necessary.
Like, you were shocked to learn that Velvet Underground had more than two albums, you know.
Right, right.
Because you'd only ever seen two. You know?
Right.
It's like, oh, shit, there's a third one?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, my God.
And even in the 70s, I knew a guy who worked at a record store next door to where I work at a bagel place, and the record store was R&B driven, but this guy was like an art rock guy. He turned me on to The Residents, to Eno, to Fred Frith, to Robert Fripp, to all that shit. And I would have never known that if it wasn't that. And it blows your mind.
Yeah, like, I used to love Fred Frith and Residents too. And I think from knowing that kind of stuff, that's how I got into other weird stuff, you know. And at least one thing leads to another. And, like, finally you end up with this magical catalog that Paul used to put out. It was just such a mind blower to read because everything was mysterious and the descriptions were incredible.
Like, what do you remember first seeing in that catalog?
This is bands you never heard of, but I mean, he would have like unforgettable lines like, this band has that going behind the bar and take a leak type vibe. And you knew you just had to hear it, you know.
So did the Sorcerers ever make a record?
No, I just played some shows around the city at the time, and it was a wild enough time or something. There was no organization to even get that far. And the only time somebody wanted to pump some money into the band, we made the wrong idea of deciding, well, we'll put on a big show instead of making a record, which would have been the smart thing.
Were you on bills with, like, the Heartbreakers and those guys?
Not with Heartbreakers, but some other ones of the time, like the Corpse Grinders. I remember being on a bill with, which had Arthur Kane. And then we used to rehearse at a place called Sunset, as I remember, something that was a Heartbreakers sort of clubhouse place. So we'd see them around there. And
a lot of nodding off, a lot of sweaty
guys.
Yeah,
there was a lot of nodding off. There were some jams with Johnny and stuff. And I remember three times over a period of a couple weeks bumping him, and he said, what's the name of your band again? What's the name of your band again?
Nice guy, right?
And yeah. You know, I hear all kinds of stories or something, but the impression I got is, well, this guy doesn't seem like, you know, dangerous or something to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think he was a hustler, but he was like, because I watched a doc about on him, and he seemed like a pretty sweet guy somewhere in there. But that sound, good fucking sound.
Sweet. I figured I'm getting my punk rock credentials on now because I am sort of meeting some people like that. And then one night, he's like, hey, you know, you want to do something with me?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm getting invited to
Shoot
some dope with Johnny Thunders. But fortunately, I had a lifelong fear of needles.
Oh,
because
you are
when I was
fortunate.
3 years old, I got bit by a dog that ran away. So I had to have these humongous rabies shots in my belly. So there was like no needles going in, which is worked out good. Because when I went back to New York and those circles of friends from there, after about 6 or 7 years, most of them were dead.
Yeah. No, you dodged a bullet, buddy. You know what? That's a relationship you don't want to have to fucking start. Good for you. God damn it, man. That drug wiped out all those fucking guys. Fucking insane.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, when did you left New York though?
That was later. Yeah. I left New York, moved to New Hampshire.
Where were you putting all these records, dude? They were all in the apartment, but when did you have to get another space to?
They were in the apartment, but by the time I had left, you know, there was still plenty of room.
But also, what's a great thing about But Paulus, yeah. he's a tastemaker, and you know he's never really been a collector. It's more like, you know, every single record that you covet has been through his fingers. But it comes to him, then he sends it out again.
Like, so, what's some records that changed your life that you wouldn't have known about except
for
Paul?
That Morgan album, for example, which I heard, you know, it's a good one to mention because it came out on a major label, but it's still, you know, one of the best and unsung albums.
Right.
It has an intriguing story, and Paul actually tracked him down and interviewed him.
And is he still around?
Yeah, I don't know where, this is going back some ways.
Yeah.
As far as I know, yeah.
What about that one that's really rare that Dan was telling me about, The Dark? Is it called The Dark?
The Dark, yeah.
What's the story on that thing, man?
That was in the early, I guess about 83, 84, 85, I would spend a couple weeks or 3 weeks each summer in England. And of course, I'd be looking around, you know, for all the records. I, you know, see these interesting records. Like, if I would have seen that Leafhound record, I'd say, oh, that's on a real label. You know,
yeah,
I'm going to buy
this
one they made themselves.
Right.
First, unless I had enough money for both. So I walked into a collector shop, you know, with all the stuff on the walls. It's like, this is the Italy only version of the cover picture of a Searchers album or whatever.
Yeah, he's
trying to, you know, hype me on this. Look at this stuff.
I
look through and I pull out a few private pressings, including The Dark, which was in the bin for £10.
Nothing.
I was looking at it thinking, you know, this looks like one of those records. And I had been walking around, so I'd already spent, I only had £30 left.
Yeah.
I found another album that I knew I had to buy for £20 because I knew it was worth a couple $100.
Which one was that?
It was, I think, a group called the Black Orchids. Nothing that significant.
Right.
But it was like, oh, okay, can't pass that up
or
something. And I took a little stack of the private pressings and said, yeah, can you play these for me? And, you know, put aside some of them and I'll come back and get them or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And he put The Dark on and I'm going, oh no, he's going to do that thing. Like, whoops, that was a mistake. That did not belong in the bins or whatever.
Right.
But instead he says, you really like this shit? I'm going, yeah, well, okay, yeah. So,
Maybe I'll give it a try. That kind of played it cool?
Yeah, sort of played it cool. And I was real excited,
And did you know about that record?
No. I was just looking at it.
Isn't that worth
totally unknown.
Thousands of dollars?
Yeah, many, yeah. They only made 99 copies, as it turns out.
And they were a British band.
And they were a British band, yeah. And it was one of those, you know, homemade private pressings.
And I got the reissue of that because of you. That someone, you know, realized it was worth something because, you know, you found that thing. So what are some other, like, bands like that that, you sort of salvaged and changed their lives? I mean, I imagine that because of you know, him reading the newsletter and other people reading the newsletter, that these bands who, some of them, like, weren't even bands anymore, almost like the old blues guys, they're working at a restaurant, and all of a sudden they get word that, like, their album's on fire again. Who were some of those bands?
It would be bands like Fraction would be one.
Yeah.
Band called The New Dawn. There's lots of Marcus from the House of Tracks. A good number of them. Sometimes when I would find them, after we got past the, you're one of my friends playing a practical joke on me. You don't really want the record.
Right.
You know?
Oh, right.
I would, after I got past that and the paranoia or the craziness of this guy Raven Back to Ohio Blues album, which is one of the craziest hard rock records ever. I remember calling him up and, you know, the phone goes and just, goodbye, and it slams down. So I just kept calling back. He wouldn't even answer his phone. Finally, he got his girlfriend on the phone. So, yeah, he's kind of out of it or whatever.
You
know, he thought you were a bill collector.
Oh, really?
Yeah. or this, but...
Were these guys able to make money when they were reissued and that kind of stuff?
Sometimes, yeah. But for the most part, back in that day, there would be bootleg reissues out of Europe or here or there. And there were some labels like Rockadelic and some other ones that started up that did track them down and, you know, try to work a deal.
Well, what do you think, what kind of person, like, you know, when you deal with people like that, and it sounds like a lot of the records were, you know, bordering on, some of them were maybe not necessarily stable people, but had enough belief in their art to try to get a record made. Who are the people that make their own records generally?
I'd say they come from all stripes. There's definitely the angle of the guy who's trying to really break into the mainstream music business and comes up with his totally bizarre take on life. And that intrigued me the most. But I'd say one of the best and most important discoveries in my life, besides the Kenneth Higney album, there's a guy named Peter Grudzian from New York who made an album called Grudzian.
Yeah.
Who made an album called The Unicorn. And he was a guy who had started in the late 50s,
yeah,
trying to, with a Johnny Cash type rock, you know, yeah, rockabilly type trio. And he's trying to break into country music.
Right.
And he was a Twilight Zone type figure. So when his record comes out, it's got early country on it and stuff, but it also has mixed in choral tapes and Music Concrete and you know, crazy words like from another world. So it sounded like somebody had said when I turned him on to, I said, this is the hillbilly from the Twilight Zone,
yeah,
or something. So I made this incredible record that's totally homemade, pretty much plays everything in isolation. He's making it, and it's not just a record we think, oh, wow, that's cool or interesting. It's a deep work of art
that right.
addresses life, death, sex, everything, like in his own sort of, you know, his own fragmented take on it, but it's real and soulful.
And,
well,
and is that record available? Did they?
Yeah. There have been a number of reissues.
What's
of
his
that.
Name? David Gray.
Peter.
Yeah.
And then G-R-U.
Yeah.
D-Z.
Yeah.
I-E-N.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I got to get that one.
Certainly. It's, you know, it was, you know, a shattering, one of those shattering experiences to me, what you were talking about with these people. This is like, by that time, I was through the gates of coming out of, like, do I need to hear another version of Gloria with a, you know, snarly garage vocal, or do I want to enter this new world, which seemed like, well, you know, I'm one of the first guys in the door here. It's
right.
It's a candy store.
Yeah, but also you got. It affected you emotionally and mentally. It wasn't like a business necessarily. You were craving the experience of having your mind blown by music, and you had worn out, you know, the shit that everybody knows. Mm-hmm. And like, I, you know, that's what I learned from you when I first got hip to you and I started, because I know, like, I get a lot of these records now, dude. A lot of people send me their records. And there's a couple of records that I've held on to because of that. Because, like, I don't know what it is. One of them was this, I have to find it. It was this woman who just played guitar, and I think her boyfriend sent me this record that he produced. And the cover picture, she looks so sad. And it looked so clearly looked like somebody said, all right, we're doing a record cover, almost like she was being yelled at. Mm-hmm. And I listened to the record. It was just heartbreaking. And it wasn't that complicated, but you could feel it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll find it for you if I can figure out what it is. So, well, there is hope for that, like, because I know you probably get asked that a lot. Like, well, can this still happen? Of course it still can happen, because I think probably more than ever, people are making their own records. Don't you think?
Yeah. Well, there are more bands than ever.
Right.
There are more records being released than ever. And it's easier to do.
Yeah. Right. You know, back in the day, somebody had to be really driven to actually get a record out, made and recorded, because it was not in their hands unless they built their own little home studio
right.
in a lot of places. So
yeah.
I think the thing now is there is so much of everything coming out, and so many things, you know, zillions of things people will be posting on the internet. And
right.
It's like the needle in the haystack. You know, there are these things that are happening right now. They're going to be really interesting, but it might take 10 or 20 years before the right ears come across them and single them out, because there's just so much.
There is. So, okay. So now you guys, you moved to New Hampshire, and what goes on up there?
That's when I really got going with the catalogs. I was basically in isolation for
the catalogs that he's that Jesper saw.
So I would be basically, you know, doing all that.
And how many records were you amassing up there? Like, did you have
that point, I had a room full of them, and then an attic with, like, the stuff that wouldn't fit in the room. So not, you know, a humongous amount, but a lot of obscure records, a good select, a large pile of select things.
What was the most expensive record you ever moved?
That would be The Dark.
It would be.
I made some money. I got like $7,500 for that, and that was a long time ago. And
who bought it?
A rare case. A friend from New York who's was a fanatic for British bands. You know, he'd heard it, so, you know, finally.
Are there still dudes that'll pay that for a record?
Yeah, certain ones. This band Stonewall, which is one of the best hard rock records ever, that was put out on a label, Tiger Lily. Uh-huh. That was the label that was owned by Morris Levy of Genovese Family Connections.
Oh, really?
And so forth.
Yeah.
And he owned Roulette Records, the famous Roulette Records. And so, he was a legendary shady figure. And he had this label called Tiger Lily that was a tax loss label, where he would put out demos people had sent to Roulette and put out records.
Without them knowing
it? Sometimes without them knowing it. Uh-huh. And they never tried to sell them. They would just manufacture.
So you don't even know where they are.
And dump them, where most of them went, you don't know. And this one, Stonewall, which I had found way back in the 80s, somebody had sent it to mm-hmm. me. I thought it was incredible. And I didn't know the story then, I think to this date, you could still count on your hand how many copies that have turned up. A copy
of Stonewall.
A copy of that sold for over $14,000 last year. So there are certain records.
And this was on the East Coast. Were they all found regionally? Because if they weren't shipped?
No, they were just scattered. The first one I had was found in Los Angeles and sent to me.
No shit.
The one that sold for $14,000, maybe the fourth or fifth known copy in the world, was found in New Hampshire in a barn.
Really?
Just
it's weird because some of those records could have just been crated up and dumped, and then somebody's got to find them.
Yeah. There was a legend going around that somewhere there's a warehouse on Long Island. They got a wall of Tiger Lily label albums, all the big ones of that. But that was somebody's imagination. Nobody ever walked into that Holy Grail scene.
Record collector mythology.
Yep.
Yeah. So what's your stock like now? Do you still have a lot of records?
No, I channel them through the whole time. So it's and once when the internet did get going, the whole thing. The source thing dried up.
Yeah.
Even in all the other countries got hip to their own records.
Right.
And then basically, the demand exceeded the supply or something. So now it's really hard to find one. And with the internet, if somebody has it, they're going to see, oh, whoa, that's a $1,000 record, whether it really is or not.
Right.
They'll take that information there. So you don't walk into a record store and go to the cheapest section to find the best stuff anymore.
Because everyone knows what they have.
Right.
All they got to do is go online and look on eBay to see what, or Discogs and see what it's going for. Sad. Are you sad about that?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. I'm glad that... I got in when it was all wide open and free,
yeah.
or something,
a lot of fun. And now because of you, thousands and thousands of people can experience and hear music they've never heard before.
Yeah, I like that. It seems like another alternate universe or something.
Sure.
With Morgan, thinking right. Now, hundreds of thousands of people are really into Morgan.
Yeah,
who could have thunk it? So now, notice when young kids and sometimes bands were playing with and other people and they start talking that kind of stuff. They have, when they're exposed to the good shit, they tend to have an innate ability to, detect it.
Right.
I think part of it sort of being like the Stooges and Velvet Underground and Black Sabbath and bands like that. Teens now are still into those bands, and they're not really listening to Genesis much anymore.
Thank God.
Or Emerson, Lake, and Palmer or things like that,
I never listened to that. You just named two bands that I could never process. I just don't know why, but it's really like it's almost like mystical what you just did, because I can get hold of most shit, but I can't get hold of Genesis.
They're incredible bands compared to Paul Simon's Graceland.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
You got to be positive about things.
what do you don't like Paul Simon's Graceland?
I don't know. It's just sinister, disturbing music.
All right. So now you come back from New Hampshire and New York.
Right.
And where do you live now? Where are you living now?
Up near Columbia University.
Still?
Yeah.
The same place that he went to as a youngster. Yeah. And so you were corresponding with Paul.
Yeah, we had some mutual friends.
Okay.
We'll go there. We would go up to his apartment and hang out and be blown.
And you just moved to New York?
Or I moved, early 90s.
How old were you?
I was like 23 or something like that.
So this was like this mystical wizard in a way.
Yeah, but it was like I was used to having older people that were guiding through this maze, because there was like not even books on this stuff. People had to know, and like the only way for me to find out is to have people teach you,
But you were a collector when you met him.
Well, a little bit. I mean, not extreme. I'd never had money or anything, but I mean, the universe is so intriguing, and Paul was the person that kind of unlocked the whole thing,
And so how did the music start?
Well, we realized we're all into the same stuff.
Right.
Paul had this, he's kind of a recluse, so he just sits up there and drinks beer and listens to all these records, and we just wanted him to get out of the house and come hang out. So we started this kind of ritual where, let's get together every Tuesday at 7, we have a rehearsal space, drink some beer, and maybe we'll make some noise,
And had you been playing at the time, much?
Not much since leaving New York and coming back. I was heavy doing the records.
So like 8 years, dealing, 9 years?
But I hadn't played.
Right.
You know, I'd pick up the guitar once in a while, but I hadn't played and never thought I'd be in a, you know, playing in a band again or something.
So that, so, but that was the original dream for you? To play
in
a band?
Yeah, as a kid. Yeah, it was. As soon as that happened, it was a real...
But this band that you started, Endless Boogie, was kind of almost like a joke or something. It was not. It was just for us.
It was just, you just wanted to jam.
We'd sit in our garage and we'd jam and we'd hang out, whatever. And we did that long. And also, you know, there was no delusions or illusions of grandeur. We never wanted to play any shows. We just wanted to hang out. And the music we played were just kind of like, I loved like Kraut Rock, but I also love Canned Heat. So. Yeah. Can we pretend that Canned Heat were a Kraut Rock band? You know, that kind of vibe. You know,
that is sort of what it sounds like.
And like, you know, what you can't do with skill, you do with volume. You know, like you just.
But also, but also commitment to a groove. I mean, that's you know, like that. That is like lately. That's one thing that I've been respecting more than anything else. Because even when I was listening to Full House Head, you know, when I was listening to Endless Boogie out of nowhere, it was exactly the experience that you were having with these other records, because it came to me, I didn't know what it was, I had no context for it, and it was just, and I started listening to it, and I lock into the groove immediately, because I do like Canned Heat, I do like John Lee Hooker, I like Kraut Rock as well, but that, the thing was, is that the groove held up. Like, it's hard to do long-ass songs, you know, that don't move around that much, and have it be, you know, satisfying. And that was happening.
And I guess it's kind of, in that regard, it's kind of an art rock project too, because where you kind of want that repetition and that becomes something else once we lock into that groove. You know, I mean, sometimes it takes us 6 minutes to get there, but once we do, we'll stay there. You know.
Yeah. For how long?
Well, it depends on. I mean, sometimes we played shows that we just played one song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if it's happening, we just keep going with it, and
you can kind of feel if you're in it. Like there's, you know, like it clicks, you know.
Uh huh.
Then you just get why leave it?
Right.
It's awesome. You want to be there. You know?
Yeah. You want to. Yeah. You're there, and then all of a sudden you want to poke around and see where else you can go.
Yeah. Yeah, but not go crazy or get too ego about it.
Yeah. Try to keep it locked into that place.
And, but it does honor a certain, like, you know, I know the name of the band is Endless Boogie, and obviously Canned Heat, we're huge John Lee Hooker fans. Like that Hooker and Heat record's one of the best records ever. Just when he says, like, I don't know how you're keeping up with me. You know that moment with the harmonica players? He must have listened to everything I ever made, because I don't know how you're keeping up with me. So, like, what was there, are you, because it doesn't strike me as, like, it doesn't read as psych rock per se. It's definitely
no.
It's definitely a blues driven operation.
Yeah, but
right?
I was never really into. I was never into stoner rock or whatever. Like, where sometimes we get put in that pocket. But I always hated metal guitar sounds.
Yeah.
Even the metal band that I liked, I was like, I wish they had like more just normal guitar sound. Right. Like, it's cooler. Like,
right.
I mean, I love the Slayer. It's like, to me, a free jazz band, and they were incredible, I thought.
Yeah.
Back in the late 80s or whatever. But I just wish they sounded a little different.
Right. Like, it seems to me that what's most important is the groove, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even, you know, I think the most important thing is the thing that you do and not what you do it with.
Agreed.
There's a lot of people who are like, oh, we're recorded in the same studio as Led Zeppelin, therefore we are as good or something. Or like, Led Zeppelin is in our music. I don't know.
It's like those people go to Berlin to record in the Hero studio.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah.
We did that U2 for Octoon Baby. Yeah, we just sucked up all that Bowie juice and we made this thing. Take it in. So, but lyrics and stuff, I mean, you sing mostly, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of it comes from stream of consciousness or something, and we're doing the jams, and something will sort of start, and we'll do it again, and, you know, don't sit down and, like, much and try to...
you write the song?
Make a statement. It's just sort of like, okay, just...
I think Sterling Morrison once said, because they used to ask, you know, every time they would interview Sterling Morrison, they would ask about Lou Reed's lyrics, and he just got, you know, he didn't like that so much. He's like, if you want poetry, read the fucking New York Times.
Right. So what are the different configurations of the band? How'd you find a bass player and a drummer? Who were those guys?
Well, the band started with, it was me and Paul and this guy, Johan Kugelberg, who is actually right now putting together a book on Paul. Oh, where good. Most of these catalog descriptions will be in. And
oh, really? A collection
like
of the catalog?
It'll be like a mm-hmm. coffee table book on Paul Major and why he's important. And
oh, that's
why,
great.
And why we all need to listen to him.
Yeah.
You know, because he's, you know, he's a man with no ego, so we need to help him out.
you need to, you're the ego fortification yeah. unit.
And me and Johan had this idea, we need to start jamming. And we wanted like a kind of a crude rock and roll band.
Yeah, yeah.
We worked in the music business, which was full of indie rock, which we thought was really annoying.
You were in the music business?
Yeah.
I worked for
Matador Records.
Oh, that was a big label for the indie rock thing.
Yeah, so we were kind of not.
Were you A&R guy?
No, I did like production and international licensing and stuff like that.
Who were the big Matador bands?
It's Pavement.
Oh,
there was a Liz Phair.
Oh yeah,
you know those were like.
I've had Malkmus in here.
Yeah, he's good.
He turns out to be a pretty good guy.
Oh, he's genius. Yeah. He's also brilliant guitar player.
And you guys work with him?
Yeah, we know him well. He's actually the reason why we ever played live, because Pavement had ended. We were friends or whatever, and he would like come hang out sometimes when we rehearsed. And he was doing his first solo album. It was like 2001.
Uh-huh.
And he's playing his first New York show. And he's like, okay, I want you guys to open.
Yeah.
So we're like, no, but we don't really play live shows.
Right.
Like, well, no, but you're going to open. It's like, okay. And that was the first time we ever played. And then we decided we'll play anytime someone asks us.
That was
play.
The deal? Uh-huh. Yeah.
And however stupid the situation would be, we would say yes. Luckily, these days, we can actually say no to some things now, but we still have the same idea. We don't really plan many tourists or anything. People contact us, hey, do you want to come to Australia, where we just were? And we're like,
I hear
yeah,
you
sure.
got a big following in Australia.
Yeah, we channel a lot of the early 70s Australian rock heroes, like Lobby Lloyd and the Colored Balls.
Uh-huh. Oh, the Colored Balls. They reissued that. Dan turned me on to that. That's a good record.
Well, we've been fans of his genius for many years, and it's one of the reasons why the band started.
Really? Yeah. How so?
Because we were just obsessing over those records, and no one else had heard of them outside Australia.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's true, like no one. And no one cared, because they were a little too rock, not psychedelic or whatever.
Right,
but
right,
I kind of
liked
the heavy rock angle.
Yeah, I got one record of theirs, I think.
Yeah, Ball Power is
Ball
one.
Power, yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah, we used to play that, That's What Mama Said, like in 1996. We tried to figure it out, but we weren't good enough.
You don't do any covers?
Well, we do sometimes.
What? Yeah. Which ones?
Well, we do Mama, Billy Thorpe.
Oh, yeah?
And the Aztecs is one. We do some covers. And
we do Rolling and Tumbling.
Rolling and Tumbling, yeah.
So, like, when you play now, what do you draw? Like, what do people know you now? Is it, like last night, how'd it go?
People, yeah, in Australia, it was good. It's not, like, huge numbers of people. We played it.
But you got a crowd.
A couple of festivals have a crowd. And
yeah.
Familiar faces turning up and diehard rock fans like that. We have a little bit of a vibe over there, too, because we've been championing Australian rock over here. And in fact, back in the old days of my catalogs, I had put a Colored Balls Ball Power in there a couple times because I was in touch with guys swapping records here. And at two of our shows, independent of each other, two guys came up and said to me, oh, thank you for turning me on to Colored Balls.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they got turned on to Colored Balls by me on halfway around the world
yeah.
or something. So we've been championing that.
What's the new record going to be called?
I think it's going to be called Vibe Killer.
Yeah.
Because there might be.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We're not, it might be. We're not calculating.
Working title is Vibe Killer. We'll see what happens.
Uh-huh.
Right. We aren't trying to make it a Vibe Killer or not.
Uh-huh.
Whatever happens. But, you know, that leaves, you know, if, in case it is the one that brings everybody down and said, oh, fuck, you know. You know, did I really like these guys? Wait a minute.
Well, I like you, man, and I was happy to talk to you, and I like the spirit of it all, and I hope I didn't seem like too much of an idiot. Jesper Eklo?
That's me.
Thank God.
Well, thank you, Mark Maron.
I wanted to make sure I got it. I didn't mean to be insulting, and Paul Major is an honor to meet you, and thanks for coming by.
Likewise.
There you go. Now set forth. Go forth and try to find Freaky Rare Vinyl. It's time. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Check my tour dates. Do that shit. And, I'll play guitar. I kind of like that thing I was doing the other day. Maybe I'll do more of that just for a second. Thank you. Boomer lives. I hope LaFonda will too.